I come from the land of wheat and wine. I pray to the gods of good crops and good times. I answered in Mother Nature.
Wine, weed, and murder. Uh-oh. Such is the stuff of Jonah Raskin in Dark Day, Dark Night. It's a marijuana murder mystery, a follow-up to his previous novel, Dark Land, Dark Mirror. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Jonah Raskin is a prolific writer and an academic and a very curious person, and I think that is why he has been so fruitful with his work. I've had the pleasure of talking with him on several occasions, and I always enjoy how our conversations amble. I try to end them, but it seems like there is always something else to talk about. And today we will listen to a few segments that fall into that category of something more to say. We now visit with Jonah Raskin on the publication of Dark Day, Dark Night, a sequel to Dark Land, Dark Mirror, where we first got to know private investigator, or an op, as she likes to call herself, Tioga Vignetta. And like the previous novel, Dark Day, Dark Night is set in a place called Sonoma. You'll recognize a lot of the context, but the author knows how to spin it up, which makes it fun for locals and non-locals alike. Let's listen to our conversation. Jonah Raskin, welcome. Happy to have you here today to talk about your latest book, Dark Day, Dark Night, which is a novel.
Yes, it is. It's fiction.
It is fiction, and yeah. It is called a marijuana murder mystery. And yeah. So before we get into talking too much about the book, I think that its predecessor, featuring a lot of the same characters, it was Dark Land, Dark Mirror.
Yes.
And I think when it was released, we had, in the state of California, medical marijuana, but maybe not adult recreational use marijuana.
Yeah, maybe it had just passed, but it wasn't hadn't taken effect yet. Yes, I would say that's about right.
And we'll talk about the book because so much of marijuana culture or a fictionalized representation of it is the setting of your book. But one of your previous books was Marijuana Land, Dispatches from
An American War.
An American War.
Yeah, yes.
And it was, I thought, a really eye-opening book, and it was fun to read whether you are a pot smoker or not.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you, since that time, I guess I'm always hoping you'll do a sequel to that book, because I suspect that since marijuana has become legalized in California and there's a lot more industrial marijuana cultivation,
yes,
that maybe we've seen a real change in growers, who's growing. Maybe some growers have been marginalized where others
yes.
have come into the market.
Yes.
And I think probably the nature of the product has changed. You know, when you look at, say, agribusiness and what it's done to our fruits and vegetables,
right.
I keep thinking it's done the same to the product, the actual product of marijuana, maybe.
Yes.
So I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that.
Right. Well, I would say California is in an odd kind of position because the citizens of the state did approve Proposition 64 that legalized adult use, 21 and over. But it takes a while to transition from the black market, which has dominated the whole marijuana economy for the last 50 years. So there's a lot of people who are staying in the black market and they don't want to change. Sooner or later, I think they'll have to change or they'll be phased out. I know I have a friend who is still on the black market and still growing illegally. He has no permits and he hasn't gone through any of the process. And I say, you know, well, why do you keep doing this? Isn't this the sooner or later? Isn't this the end of the road for you? And he's not willing to give it up. You know, if he gets in trouble with the law, he says that he'll fall back on Proposition 215, which was the medical marijuana. So he's a bit duplicitous because, I mean, he claims that his marijuana is all for medical purposes and he's giving it to people in need. But maybe that's only about 15% of his total crop and the rest of it he's selling.
And I also wonder if there is a clientele that also prefers purchasing that way and maybe has not transitioned well into the legal economy as consumers.
Yes, exactly. There are people who have bought directly from the farmer or from some maybe a middle person, and they don't want to go to a dispensary where they're going to have to pay more. They're going to have to, because there's tax added to it. The state of California, the Bureau of Cannabis Control just is launching a campaign to persuade citizens to only buy from licensed dispensaries and not buy on the black market. And they're doing a big advertising campaign. They're going to have billboards.
Well, that's interesting because I know that from a regulatory perspective that even legal growers sometimes run afoul of environmental quality laws.
Oh,
and
gosh.
There's a lot of mess out there, even from, quote, legal growers. And so I think that as we're talking about the tax base or taxing the product, I think that that's going to help support some of the mobilization of programs that ensure that our water quality isn't impacted and that
yes.
sort of thing. So it's I find it's an interesting process to watch in our society right now in that mistakes will be made, but also hopefully evolution.
It's definitely an interesting process. It's ongoing. You know, it will take some time. You have to. I was trying to explain to somebody about even though adult use is legal, it's not. In fact, marijuana in the fabric of society, it's not legal. And I was saying, well, you know, a long time ago, President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. Or a couple of them, I believe, but we still don't have full civil rights in this country. So,
right, right. No, that is true. I have to say, just anecdotally, that some of my friends who would have never considered cannabis or marijuana or smoking or imbibing have been kind of sold on. This is a benign form of sleep therapy, or I have aches and pains or arthritis,
yes.
and I'm going to try this. And then they're amazed when they actually find relief. So I think there's that kind of change happening, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yes. For, I would say, the last year or so, the largest percentage of people going to dispensaries have been older people, like 50s, 60s, 70s, maybe people who smoked a joint in the 60s or 1975, and now they have aches and pains, and they heard that marijuana that has the chemical compound called CBD is good for pain, and so they're buying their medicine and taking their medicine.
Right.
They're not just getting stoned or getting high.
Right, and don't necessarily want to. They actually do want the medicinal qualities that it has to offer. So it's a changing time, but I think you're right. It is going to take some time.
Right. I did hear Mike McGuire, who's in, I believe he's a state senator, and he spoke about a year ago, and he said he thought it would take 5 years before it was all really actually legalized in the state of California.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So there are, the last couple of weeks, there have been big raids on marijuana plantations in California, like tons and tons of marijuana confiscated. I don't know of any around here, but like in Riverside County, I mean, huge grows down there.
I know Calaveras County has kind of really taken off as a dope growing place.
Yep.
Yep. Well, all of this, we could probably just do a whole show talking about this.
Yes.
But it is the setting of your book. As I said, this is a follow-up to Dark Land, Dark Mirror.
Yes.
Which I think was that called an eco-noir mystery.
Right.
Whereas this is a marijuana murder mystery. And even though all of the same characters or a lot of the same characters are involved.
Yes.
They all, or many of them, are in a haze of being stoned at some point.
Yes.
And there is I would say a difference, a little bit difference even in the storytelling.
Yes, probably. You might be a better judge than I, Suzanne. I mean, it's, you know that I knew Doris Lessing.
Yeah.
And I would always, very often, and not always, but often I would ask Doris Lessing, well, you know, what does your novel mean? Or what did you know? And she would say, well, I wrote the book. You're the reader. You're the critic. You tell me what it means to you.
Yes.
So, but there are a lot of people who want me to say, well, what is the message? What's the moral of your book? That's very difficult for me to say.
Yeah. Though I think in some ways we could, in many ways we can talk about the evolution of its writing. I had the good fortune, I would say, of reading the book in an early draft.
Yeah.
And really, you've made a lot of changes, especially in the way the story opens. And
yes.
So, and I think that's what I mean about the storytelling too. And,
right.
And so maybe you can address, how do you pick up on characters? How did you move from those initial drafts to this published story?
Right. Well, I mean, I have the same main character, Tayoga Vinyera. She was the private investigator, detective in the first one, and she's back on the job in her second one. I think she's probably a more complex character in the second book than she was in the first book. I know that when I first started writing the second book, that I was very attached to Tayoga. And I liked her, and I didn't want any bad things to happen to her. But then I realized, well, no, but that's not going to make for a good story. I mean, she's a detective. She's putting herself in harm's way. And so you're going to just have to let her do that, get into danger and get into trouble, and then figure out how she's going to get out of it. So I think to a large extent the way that I worked on Dark Day, Dark Night was to sit down and to write a scene, a small part, and then to, I don't know, leave it there and to like go off and think about what should happen next and how to amp up the story. And you know, there's certain threads that get introduced, and then how to develop those threads and how to complicate them. I was on campus, and I was recently, and I was talking to two students, and I said that I was writing a murder mystery, and just spontaneously, one of them said, "Oh, twists and turns." So, yes, so that's what I kept trying to introduce. It's it goes this way, then it goes that way, and then it seems like this person maybe is a suspect, and then maybe it's this other person, and how are these people connected? And I would say that not all of the mysteries are solved. I mean, there's at least one marijuana crop. There's probably actually more than one crop in this book that disappears. Somebody has stolen it. And Tara's trying to figure out where is it going, who did this and where is it going. And at the end of the book, she doesn't catch up to it. It's gone. By the time she gets there, it's gone.
Right.
So that is inspired, I would say, in part by the ending of The Maltese Falcon, Dashiell Hammett's novel, where the characters are looking for this valuable statue. So when I was starting out, I said, well, what's valuable if I'm setting it in Sonoma County? A statue doesn't really sound believable, but marijuana is very valuable. And Tony Liniger, the agricultural commissioner for Sonoma County, said not long ago, marijuana is so valuable, people are willing to kill for it. So,
And that's, there is murder in this book. We find out pretty quickly that Tioga is investigating a murder of a young woman. And yet, that is the stuff, as your students or the people you were talking to alluded to. I mean, there's a crime, there's a mystery, but it really is the interaction of the characters, the way
yes.
you describe that,
yes.
and the twists and turns that make the story. My observation about these characters, many of whom, if you read the first book, appear there, was that in this book they're just a little more whacked,
yes.
a little more whacked out, a little bit more
yes.
on the edge and stoned a lot.
Yes, they're definitely wackier. They're definitely like there's an edginess. While I was writing the book, a friend of mine would tell me she was enrolled in a writing class, and the teacher said, if you don't know what to do, just jack it up and make it even more wild and exciting and dangerous coming off. So I borrowed that idea, and there's one time when Tioga and her friend Camilla they're going to get Camilla's car, and somebody has bashed in her car. Well, that's an example of I just don't having them go up and the car is fine and everything's all right. But it's been totally trashed and the tow truck takes it away. Yes.
And also it seems that Tioga, as we have mentioned, Tioga Vignetta is the op, the private
yes.
eye in the book. And she is really always reaching for her gun, making sure she has her gun.
Yes.
And there were a lot more guns in this.
Yes.
In this, and I almost felt like the telling of the story in this book was kind of like a graphic novel without the graphics, in a way, just the storytelling
yes.
had that kind of color and background detail that maybe you might find in a graphic novel.
Yeah, that's a good way of describing it, I would say. So, and I would also, near the end, there's a couple of endings, not the very, very ending, but there is a scene near the end that takes place at a Mexican restaurant where there's this kind of nutty guy, Billy Bones, who takes this boy hostage and is holed up in the restaurant, and the police surrounding the place, and Tioga is there, and there's a shootout. I mean, it's like it's Hollywood. I just totally went for kind of blockbuster Hollywood ending there.
And yes, there is a lot of slithering into narrow spaces or being off in rooms in the basement of the hotel and that
yes.
kind of thing, where you
right.
do kind of question what is going to happen next. So that must have been a lot of fun for you to write.
I would say it mostly was fun to write. Yes, exactly.
And so even the writing or rewriting or restructuring of the book, how, are you a big rewriter?
Well, I think I'm a big writer, rewriter. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's the way the book ends now with a helicopter raid on a marijuana plantation. That's not the original way that it began, but it seemed like to me it needed to begin with some real punch.
Right. Yeah. I would agree. I thought the way in the published version that you opened the book was a lot stronger, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. So thanks for the ability, though, for me to see that transition was kind of fun.
So in the first book, Tiger does not have a gun, or she doesn't wear a gun. She doesn't use a gun. She is. She's definitely edgy. She's drinking quite a lot of alcohol, consuming
right.
alcohol, and she
Tons.
Is smoking marijuana.
Tons.
And she's just on edge from the work that she's doing, getting involved with all these creepy characters.
And there are a lot of really creepy characters in this book. And even she was married to one of them.
Yes.
And she is having some relationship turnaround, too. And with her, yes, girlfriends,
yes.
seems like there's a little bit of transition there. So
yes.
a lot of characters in transition. But there's a lot of pot and alcohol, and it seemed like you might have even had some fun with the food too. There's a chef,
yeah.
there's a bartender and a chef in the book who
yes.
are characters that are like brilliant at what they do.
Yeah, yes, there's Frank, rather Sean Dice. He's the bartender, who's one of Tiger's really good friends. He's a great source of information. He's like a rock. She can always go to the bar. And he's always there, and he's always supportive. And so he's there at the end. And then there's also there's Johnny Field, who's a fantastic chef. And he's working in the hotel, and people come to the town to eat his food because he's so great.
I think it's interesting, Jonah, that you are largely known for your works of nonfiction. And some of that work of nonfiction is all about food and wine and pot. And here your work of fiction is like all that stuff is percolating up into your fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. There are some places in the book that are based on actual places. I mean, there's the Mexican restaurant, which is kind of inspired by a real Mexican restaurant. I read part of that chapter to some people who live in the town of Sonoma, and they couldn't guess. They didn't know the actual place I was inspired by. So, but I mean, I did change it in a lot of significant ways. One of the subplots is that there's a robbery at El Buen Comer, the Mexican restaurant. There's $100,000 that's stolen from the restaurant. Well, that's actually based on a real robbery at a Mexican restaurant in Sonoma. The woman who owns the restaurant told me about it. Why did she tell me about it? Well, a lot of people tell me a lot of things. Sometimes I feel like I'm a kind of father confessor, or people know that I'm a writer and they want somebody to know these things. So I have great sources. And then my younger brother, Adam, is a private investigator in San Francisco. And I connected him with the woman whose restaurant was robbed. And his first comment to me was, it was an inside job.
I think it's fascinating that you yourself in some of your work as an author are like a private detective in a way. You're sleuthing things, you're identifying yes. things, and your brother's involved in that as well.
Yes.
And so I think it's just fascinating that now you kind of funnel all that into fiction.
Yes. Well, I started off writing about marijuana for newspapers and magazines. Then the next, I worked on the movie called Homegrown, which was a Hollywood, not a huge budget. It was like $4.5 million. I created the characters and the action. I didn't write the dialogue. And I was on the set and I consulted with the movie. So I took some of my ideas and put them in cinema, film version. And then the book you mentioned, Marijuana Land, in the Dispatches from an American War, is a roving reporter who is looking into different aspects of the marijuana world in Northern California. Yeah. You know, with real people, mostly with their names used, and looking at Humboldt and Mendocino and Sonoma, and you know, doctors and lawyers, dealers. So some of the characters I said, like the bartender, Sean Dice, the bartender, in the book, I spell his name D-Y-C-E. Well, he is based on my friend Frank Dice, D-I-C-E, who used to be a bartender in Grayton, and I believe he's a bartender in Santa Rosa now. So there's some fictional characters are very close to, or, well, I don't know if they're very close, because when I have them speak, I'm making up the dialogue. But it does some of the time it helps to have a kind of picture in my own head of what this person looks like. Yes.
I'm talking with Jonah Raskin, whose latest work of fiction is Dark Day, Dark Night. It is a marijuana murder mystery, and it's the follow-up to his book, Dark Land, Dark Mirror. And Jonah, I'm wondering what you have going next. It seems like you always have maybe more than one thing going on at a time, and I'm wondering if you're going to stay in the vein of fiction, or might we see another nonfiction come out from you?
Well, I'd like to, and I've started on the third in the series, so the trilogy with Tioga. The working title for that is Dark Page, Dark Rage. Dark Page, Ooh. Dark Rage. So similarly to Dark Day, Dark Night, which takes people into the marijuana world, the new one takes people into the world of Jack London. I mean, Jack London State Park.
Wow.
The Jack London Foundation, Jack London fans.
The burning of Wolf House.
Yes. I mean, there's scenes that I've already written that are set at the park. I got to a point a couple days ago where I wasn't sure how it was. I wrote something, and then I didn't like it at all. It was just too leaden. And then I thought, well, what if Tioga thinks that Jack London comes and sits down and talks to her? So, I mean, I have had kind of surreal things. Like in the first one, right. There's a rain of frogs. I mean, right. Sometimes there are actually rain of frogs, but it does lend a sort of surreal quality to it. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think that's pushing it. Like,
but, you know, Jonah, sometimes, and for those listeners and readers who have been to Jack London State Park or read about Jack London, sometimes when you're there, especially when you're visiting, you know, his house and the remains of Wolf House, sometimes you kind of feel that
yes.
presence. And so I can say that That's an intriguing notion, and I think we'll all look forward to seeing that. But again, the coming together of your personal interests. You've been long interested in Jack London and have written about him and anthologized his work. Yeah. So this coming together, I think, is really something to look forward to.
Yeah, so I have a lot of different threads here. I have two candidates running for office who get mixed up in everything. I have blackmail. I was telling a friend of mine, I said, well, I have a woman who has posed for some photographs, and the person who has the photographs from her past when she was younger, she posed nude, and there's a photographer. Well, this is somebody who gets in touch with her and says, if you don't pay me, I'm going to publicize these photos, and your name will be mud. So that is the beginning of Tayoga getting involved in the case. The woman hires Tayoga to go and negotiate with the blackmailer.
Well, we will look forward to that. And thank you so much for this book and for coming in and talking to us today, Jonah.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We formally ended the interview, but kept talking, and I have to share that with you. I am Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Let's listen to Jonah and I kibitzing just a bit more. And I don't know if there was anything else you wanted to talk about, but I wondered, is there something you want to read? Do you have something you generally read at readings?
No, I haven't really read some.
And we don't have to. I think I've got plenty of material here.
Okay. All right. So one thing I did want to say is that I'm trying to address the subject of violence against women. I mean, it opens with this woman who's murdered, and then there's Dorothy Baines. She's like abused and then murdered.
It seems like women are. We could talk about that because it was something I noticed that there was. Women aren't treated very well, and even towards the end of the book, when they're in a kind of old building and warehouse, and just the women who I guess are pot trimmers or something.
Yes.
We're really not treated very well,
exactly.
and murder and abuse does happen to women in the book.
So I would say Tayoga is not carrying a banner for feminism or feminist, but she is motivated to find out who's murdering these women. And Why are they being killed? So,
and it seems that there's also a couple of children who are kind of peripheral damage, or what, because of recklessness on the part of Terry McCoy, one of the characters in the book, and a lot of sleazy men in the book.
Yes, there are. So I'm trying to think, are there any decent men? Well, Frank Dice is decent.
And it seems like the guy who runs the coffee cart.
Yes, Aaron Holmes is decent. Exactly. Camilla's a decent person, and her mother, who's a cook.
Her mother is probably the most decent in the book, I'd say. Yes.
She's the one who's really standing up for herself and her culture.
Yeah. And, actually, Jonah, that was something I had wanted to ask you about. You have a lot of, there are many Hispanic characters in the book. There are some Indian brothers, some Yaqui brothers that I thought were a little twist. But you pepper Spanish, Mexican phrases throughout out the book. And I sometimes wonder, I know I took French lessons at a point in time because I was so sick of encountering French terms that I didn't understand.
Yes.
And as an author, how do you judge what is enough for color and what readers might not understand?
Well, people have access to their phones these days, so...
So you don't worry about it.
I don't. I was interviewing Diane DePrima, the poet, a while ago, and I said, well, Diane, people probably don't know who Sacco and Vanzetti is in your poem. She said, well, they can look it up. So I think I followed Diane DePrima's path there. I did show... Flor is the woman from Mexico who has rudimentary English. And I showed those passages to my friend Alejandro. And he helped me rewrite it so it would be more authentic, more in keeping with a woman from Mexico doesn't know English very well, yes.
So that it's less of a caricature from a white author.
Yeah, that's my hope. Yeah. Yes, you know, he was very kind to go through it and suggest, you know, she probably would say this or she could say that. And, you know, he was bilingual and he's a reader and also part of the marijuana world. And so... And goes back and forth across the border quite a lot.
And I guess, you know, this is set in a place called Sonoma, or, you know, a fictionalized version of Sonoma and the Valley of the Moon there. But I wondered how much of the infusion of marijuana culture into the wine culture. How close is that? I realize this is a work of fiction, but it seems like there may be this growing pot tourism.
Yes, there is pot tourism in the Valley of the Moon, and it's growing. I was on a pot tour, which went from the plaza in Sonoma up to a farm in the Mayacaimas. There are chefs who are cooking with cannabis and inviting people. There's the Wine and Weed Symposium that takes place in Santa Rosa the third year. And so I would say they're coming closer together. Over the last few years, there's been a couple of men who made their names in growing grapes and making wine, who have been growing or were growing marijuana for decades and just recently came out. And one of them, Mike Benzinger, I'm not wearing his hat, but he's growing commercial marijuana that's in dispensaries.
And so he comes in with a name that people know.
Yes, right.
Well, all right, Jonah Raskin, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. It's great.
I've been talking with Jonah Raskin on his book, Dark Day, Dark Night. And now we know that it is the second installment of a trilogy.
We come from the land of weed. Pray to the gods of good crops and good times. We answered Mother Nature, who ain't always kind. The gifts that she gives us get us through the
As I said, I have had the great pleasure of recording conversations with Jonah over the course of several years, And I want to bring you really one of the most personally revealing conversations I've had with him. It was upon the release of his book, A Terrible Beauty, The Wilderness of American Literature. He reflects on this time of year in California, among other things, and I thought you might enjoy listening. His describing California's golden, brown, dry landscape really resonated with me. As an immigrant to the West, it took several years to fully appreciate and understand this landscape. It might resonate with you, too. Enjoy. I wonder, did you have a personal epiphany or at some point in your life come to find the value you derive from being in nature?
Well, I know that I was in woods and forests from a very early age. I do have very clear memories of from boyhood of getting on my bicycle and riding from my house where I lived with my brothers and my family and being able to go into the woods and explore there and just... I do remember a specific grove of cedar trees. There was a special smell about them and their bark, and I liked to be in that place. I just felt happy there. And I also took a very early interest in birds. I can't remember anybody telling me about birds, or I don't think I knew an ornithologist. But I remember being very interested in birds' nests and bird calls, and I loved to see the nests of the Baltimore Orioles that we had back east. And so that experience, and also with the Long Island Sound, the body of water where I was the Long Island Sound, and it was growing up in the 50s, it was still unpolluted. You could get seafood from harvest sea foraging. I was didn't know the word foraging, but I was an early forager. I became aware of the California environment, I would say. It took a while, but I started to get attached to the hillsides around here in Northern California in September or October after months of no rain. Where the sun has been beating down and they're turning golden or brown or even, you know, in this past winter, some of the hillsides even turned like kind of brown black. Somebody said it was a kind of fungus that was on plants that turned them that color. So I got to see the beauty, not in the lush green landscape, but this very dry golden or brown landscape. I mean, the hillsides around here are really spectacularly beautiful. I hope that they're not going to be covered with houses. I know that they've been inspiring to artists like Jack Stupin, and sometimes when I look at the landscapes, I see it through his eyes or through his landscapes. And that has enabled me to feel at home here. I know that I also began to feel connected to the landscape here when I met local farmers and worked on organic farms. I mean, the farm that I have felt the most connection to is Oak Hill Farm in Glen Ellen, where there's no gate that you have to close and open to get in. There's no fence around the place. It has about 40 acres of cultivated fields, and then it has about 700 acres of woodland, and there's no barrier between what we've called the wild and the cultivated, and creatures are going back and forth, and it's a great watershed. I think that it helps to provide all kinds of habitat, and I think that it makes the land that's cultivated richer, and I mean, it also adds to the beauty of the place. Again, in the story that I heard on the radio coming here, somebody from Marin talking about salmon, about houses being built too close to streams and it having a harmful or deleterious effect on the water and spawning grounds for salmon. So, yes, couldn't we sort of back away from nature? Couldn't we give it some breathing space and from streams and And rivers, I think that it's, I mean, just sitting here thinking now, I mean, I think it's really a responsibility of our generation to keep our waterways healthy and to keep our hillsides from being commercially developed. I mean, over in Glen Ellen, there's private land, and then there's also the regional park that's there. So there's a kind of green belt that's there to have green belts, and whether we call them, you know, whatever we call them, parks or wild, they're really essential. So one of the other things that's happening nowadays is people are saying, well, we need to have the wild places close by. So there's talk now, for example, of urban wild.
And
there was a conference that took place in September in Vallejo that was in part about this, and that I attended, and that was really inspiring. And although there were also some difficult stories or stories that were hard to hear that were told by some of the Indians from California. But there was a walk around the seashore in Vallejo. The ocean is a very wild place. I often go out to Point Reyes, and you get to the end of land and you look out at the Pacific, and that's really wild. I mean, I know there's also all kinds of garbage floating around there. I mean, the Pacific, the oceans are another kind of wilderness that we also have to save. I mean, it's all around us.
But I think the understanding of what nature can provide to us, both spiritually, physically, and yes, as a culture. And I hope that your book might be a pathway for some people. Your book is steeped in our literary heritage, that it's something you have obviously observed through the course of your literary life. And in reading the book, I have to say that I probably had a very shallow look at some of these books. I'm struck by you saying it was an American thing to read American literature, and I hope that's the excitement that is brought to many classrooms. I feel that in my own education, which I think was a good education, I didn't see the work that way. I found it hard to understand, and so maybe I just didn't have the right teacher.
Well, it's possible. It's possible. So some of my friends, both inside and outside of academia, have told me that this book can be useful because there's a lot of talk these days about climate change, global climate change, and a lot of it, they say, comes from the sciences and environmental sciences and biology, and that there is a need for humanities classes and humanities approaches to climate change and the environmental issues that are happening here. So that is, I would say, is one of my deepest hopes, is that this book finds readers in colleges and high schools who care about what's happening globally, the whole global environmental crisis that we're in, and to be able to look back at our literature and to learn, to take lessons from this vast storehouse of our literature. Yeah. So.
Well, Jonah, thanks so much for coming in and talking about your book. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with about A Terrible Beauty? And maybe you'll tell us where you got the title from, A Terrible Beauty.
Yeah, yes. The title is from a poem by William Butler Yeats, the Irish poet. So I selected that because I think that if people saw the wilderness as a place of beauty, but they were also terrified by it. So and the two of those things seemed like they kind of, sometimes they merged. I mean, the idea is also expressed in a William Blake poem, A Fearful Symmetry, where he's writing about the tiger, 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 burning bright in the forests of the night. This sort of the fear we've had of this sort of very beautiful places in the world. There's something about beauty that seems to terrify.
I think we also have an irrational, well, I think it's irrational fear of animals, of big animals. We have wolves that are finding their way, just a few, back into California. Mm-hmm. Yet there is this fear about what the wolves are going to do.
Yes.
And even cougars, mountain lions, if they pick off a sheep now and then, they must be destroyed. And so I think we still harbor that fear of things that maybe it is irrational. We have guns.
Yes. Well, I was talking about Oak Hill Farm and not fencing out or not keeping out the forested wild place. There are mountain lions in the Myokymus that are just above the fields. And I mean, I know that, and they know it because they have motion detector cameras up there. I've seen the images of the lions, and so for a very long time, they've been able to live there and farm there and work there and the mountain lions and all kinds of other critters have been up there, and they've been able to live side by side, nobody being attacked, and no animals, no hunting parties going up there to kill them. So I also wanted to say that Wallace Stegner, who was a very influential and inspiring environmental writer from the 20th century, talked about the geography of hope, that when he looked at the landscape, led him to sort of optimism and to be inspired. And there is that ending in The Great Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, in which he imagines this group of Dutch sailors who've just come from across the Atlantic Ocean from Europe, and they see the New World, and it's green, and it's wonderful, and it's beautiful, and it's like they've never seen anything, and they have this incredible sort of sense of wonder. F. Scott Fitzgerald, he definitely wanted to end the book on this sort of hopeful note. He didn't want to end it with Gatsby's death, or he didn't want to end it with this description he has earlier in the book of what he calls the wasteland, where everything is polluted, and the rivers and the air, and it's all gray and dark. And
I thought that was a different perspective of Fitzgerald and The Great Gatsby, and I appreciated your being able to bring that out, because I think it might not be something that we all would have gotten.
Yes, I haven't heard too many people, if any, really notice that part of the book. People usually say it's about class or the American dream. And I think that the recent movie of the Great Gatsby with Leonardo DiCaprio, it sort of missed the whole environmental part of the book, really. That's crucial for F. Scott Fitzgerald. I grew up in Gatsby country. I grew up on Long Island when I was a boy. I was talking about the woods that I could go to. I also saw in my boyhood the end of those woods and fields and the coming of suburbia and tract housing every place. But reading The Great Gatsby from an environmental glasses on, I did notice that Fitzgerald writes about the lilacs and frogs and this great expanse of the Long Island Sound that he is writing about people with fast cars and big houses, but he also notices that there's this really spectacular natural landscape there. I would like to hope that people can slow down and really notice the wild maybe in their own backyard. There's some corner just outside their kitchen door that they let they don't have lawn there or they don't have flowers, but things are all kind of rank and sort of growing according to their own whim. And there's something satisfying about having those places. I live very close. It's in the parcel right next to me. It's a small organic farm, and there's a border of trees, and there's a creek that's running through there. So I like this balance between the cultivated and the wild, and I think that I hope that we can learn to have in urban environment. This is one of the things that's happening now, to have wild places in urban settings, because it takes a lot to get out of San Francisco or Oakland and to go to Yosemite. Some people don't have the wherewithal to do it, but increasingly people want that connection. And there are places where there's reforestation in Richmond, for example, and kids, young people are going there and they're learning to appreciate it.
I just want to say that you do, quote Gary Snyder, and it's just what you were just talking about. The wild is a territory, not a part of the agency of humanity. It could be a strip of earth in your own backyard, or it could be Yosemite. Wherever it is, it takes care of itself.
Yeah. Yes. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. A Terrible Beauty, The Wilderness of American Literature by Jonah Raskin. Jonah, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
What I love about that conversation is Raskin's message of hope through looking at our past, at our literary past, and going deep on who we are as Americans in the light of our history and culture. We are in a pivotal moment right now where this sort of reflection and understanding is demanded of us as readers and as authors. Thank you, Jonah Raskin, for sharing your insights through A Terrible Beauty, The Wilderness of American Literature, and for wrapping us in our storytelling traditions with the noir fiction, Dark Land, Dark Mirror. I am Suzanne Lang, and I thank you for listening. We have production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell.
We've heard Weed and Wine from Pi Jacobs, local Sonoma County girl who's gone to L.A., Pi Jacobs.
Subscribe to our podcast at norcalpublicmedia.org. This is a production of KRCB-FM and Lit Radio. It's a novel idea.